You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, good morning. I guess we can start now. Sorry for the slight delay. We were waiting for a few more people to arrive. My name is Adnan Vatansever. I'm a senior associate here at Carnegie's Energy and Climate Program. And it's a great pleasure for me to welcome you all to this event. We are hoping that this will be part of a series of events that will be exploring the key questions that are affecting energy consumption and energy production. And I would like to mention a few things about the Energy and Climate Program here. David Burwell, who is the director of the program and also sitting over there, he's been leading efforts in developing a very comprehensive program that is aiming to tackle the question about carbon emission reductions. And in this comprehensive approach, the goal is to tackle both the demand side and the supply side of the energy balance. And one of the areas that some of the projects that we have been working on are basically about reducing energy consumption and energy efficiency. But we also believe that there are opportunities for carbon reduction by focusing on the fuel mix of individual countries, particularly the fossil fuel mix of individual countries, and probably also on much more ambitious global scale. And when it comes to fossil fuel mix, I guess then it becomes a question about the future of natural gas, as it's known to be the cleanest fuel. So I think that it is a very timely event, partly because natural gas markets have become dramatically uncertain in the past couple of years. This has been partly because of the unconventional gas revolution that has spread in the US and raises questions about how it will spread elsewhere. It is also partly because of the glut that has been creating by the global recession, but it is also because it's also partly because of the changing dynamics in how natural gas is being priced, particularly in Europe these days. And this particular question is the focus of the report that we are launching today, The Natural Gas Pricing and Its Future. If you haven't received the report, we should have quite a few copies outside. And we're fortunate to have Tony Melling, the author of the report. He is going to be sharing his insights, his main conclusions about how the price dynamics has been developing. And he argues that Europe is the battleground, and it raises quite interesting questions about the future of gas pricing elsewhere as well, particularly in Asia. I'd like to say a few words about Anthony Melling, and I'm sure you have all of the speakers' bios here, but I'll be very brief. He's an established authority on gas contracts. He has 3 decades of international gas contracting and market analysis experience, with particular emphasis on the UK and continental Europe. Tony gained early experience in British gas exploration and production. In the mid-90s, as the UK oversupply began to revolutionize the UK gas industry, he drafted an influential analysis of the situation that helped shape management's response. Subsequently, he studied and analyzed contracting practices across the continent. His models were widely employed in the company's planning. On leaving BG in 2000, Tony focused on European gas contracting practices and, as a consultant, was active in several areas, including energy marketing, energy purchasing for large industrial plants and power generation, and LNG. Now, before giving him the floor, I'd like to do 2 things in particular. First, I'd like to briefly summarize the structure of today's 2 panels, and then I would like to provide a very quick overview, probably in less than 5 minutes, an overview of the global gas markets, because I think it might be helpful for those that are less familiar with gas, but also because it will set the background for Tony's presentation. So, regarding the structure of the event, in the first panel, Tony will be speaking about 25, maybe 30 minutes, and then we'll have time for a Q&A session. After that, we have about 10 minutes break. And during the second panel, we are having 5 very distinguished discussants. Each of them will take one major question related to the natural gas markets, and particularly related to Tony's report as a response. One of the questions will be on power generation. Branko Terzic will focus on that. The other question will be on the future of unconventional gas. Velo Kuskra, a leading authority in unconventional gas in the US, will focus on that. We'll have Mikhail Korchemkin, who will explore how exporters are adapting to the changing natural gas market dynamics. And we'll also have the importer's perspective from Tokyo Gas, from Hidehiro Nakagami. And after a Q&A session, Chris Goncalves will provide an overview, and he has one very challenging question to address, which is, are the regional gas markets converging in some way, or are they likely to converge in any time in the near future? Having said this, just a very quick overview of the global gas markets, and I would like to go over three particular themes. The first is consumption of gas versus other fossil fuels. The second is the growing role of internationally traded gas. And the third is how gas is priced worldwide. It's interesting to look at this chart, which shows how oil, coal, and gas consumption grew over the past 40 years. For those that are probably less familiar with gas, it's interesting to see that even though it's known to be the cleanest fuel, it actually trails behind oil and coal in terms of global consumption. If you would take China out of the picture, though, you have the chart on the right side where you can see that gas consumption surpassed coal consumption about 20 years ago. And particularly during the past decade, it actually grew about four times faster than oil consumption and about, again, four times faster than coal consumption. Where did the growth come from, particularly in the past decade? By 2008, for the 8 years from year 2000, the growth was about 600 BCM. Much of that came from Asia Pacific, from Europe, CIS, and also the Middle East. And in each of these three regions, you have three leading countries. You have China, Russia, and Iran. In each of these countries, the growth in consumption was by around 60 billion cubic meters a year. In 2009, growth continued in the Asia-Pacific region and the Middle East, whereas in all of the remaining regions, there was a contraction because of the recession. Prospect for future growth, I will not go into many details here, but generally, the expectation is that the growth will be around 42%, according to IEA, by 2030, and most of this will come from emerging markets and the Middle East. And I should also mention that there are some much more ambitious forecasts. For instance, PetroChina expects that this will increase up to 300 billion cubic meters by 2020, which is almost twice more what IEA is predicting. Regarding trade, I guess the main conclusion that we can draw for trade is that while gas consumption has been growing by about 22% since 2000, trade has been growing three times faster. In the case of LNG, it's been growing a little bit faster than that, than piped gas. So overall, now internationally traded gas accounts for about 30% of globally consumed gas, whereas this share was as low as 22% only 10 years ago. And the final point is about how gas is priced, and I guess this will be probably the most useful thing to do in order to set the context for Tony's presentation. I try to draw a very brief summary here based on the International Gas Union's methodology. They are distinguishing between gas that is produced and consumed domestically and gas that is traded internationally. And they distinguish generally between three types of pricing. One is regulated, the other one is oil index, and the third type of pricing is spot market pricing. In case of domestic production, most of the sales are basically on regulated basis. There is a significant share for spot sales, primarily because the US, UK, and Australia are also big producers of gas, and also they sell the gas mostly in their domestic market. In case of piped gas, piped imports, predominantly it is based on oil indexation. This is the case pretty much for almost all Russian gas, with very few recent exceptions, and Algerian gas. This is predominantly the case for Norwegian imports in Europe and also Dutch imports in Europe. And The main exceptions here where you see spot markets, this is about the cross-border trade in North America and also trade that involves the UK, and you also have a few other exceptions globally. For LNG imports, the share of oil indexation is even larger and there are much fewer exceptions, primarily, again, in North America, a few exceptions in Europe and also in Asia. Well, thank you for the attention. And now I would like to give the floor to Tony.
Well, thank you very much, Adnan, for opening up the presentation. Okay. Natural gas pricing is not often a hotly debated topic. However, in Europe, it has become exactly that. There is a collision between two cultures about how natural gas should be priced, and the shockwaves are impacting the whole world. The problem is that the price of gas purchased under European long-term contracts is linked to the price of oil. Starting around 2008, a new surge of natural gas sold under short-term contracts at commodity prices became available and changed the landscape dramatically. Commodity price gas was at times selling for half the price of oil index gas. The incumbents lost control of the market and ended the year owing billions of dollars to the producers for committed volumes that they could not take. In mid-2009, the situation was clearly not sustainable even for the next 12 months, let alone the 30-year contract terms. As a defensive measure, long-term contracts were hastily revised, and the shockwaves spread also to Asia, where similar pricing principles apply. The total value of European oil-indexed natural gas contracts exceeded $2 trillion US dollars, and the crisis impacted on the gas sales revenues essential to the governments of Russia and Algeria. As a result, the issue is already reshaping relationships between EU sovereign governments and those of the major gas suppliers. It is also influencing the development of major gas resources and even the planned direction of gas flows out of Russia. The issue is also reshaping the patterns of interfuel competition and gas consumption in Europe and across the world. The outcome has the potential to determine the role of gas as a bridging fuel in the transition towards a low-carbon economy. It is, by any definition, a major issue. Okay, the oil indexation story begins here. Shell and Exxon discovered the supergiant Groningen field in 1959 at 2,800 BCM. It was a supergiant field. It wasn't the first natural gas developed in Europe, but it was a massive quantity of cheap-to-develop gas at the epicenter of European energy demand. Commercially, Europe had seen nothing like it. The Groningen field alone had the ability to generate about 15 billion per year at today's wholesale prices. Europe already had a gas industry, but this project was so large that it needed to attract customers away from other fuels. Partner Exxon formulated a marketing and pricing plan. Exxon proposed linking the price of gas in each market segment to the end user's alternative fuels and to discount in order to rapidly gain market share. The pricing principles were developed. Gas would be priced on the basis of its energy content as a percentage of recent oil prices, and the price would be updated every 3 months. The proposal was sold to the Dutch government and announced by the Dutch Minister of Economic Affairs in the now famous Nota de Puys. This was the beginning of what became known as oil-indexed pricing in Europe. Here's the basic principle. Gas flows from the top downwards, from the producers to the end customers. Pricing, oil index pricing, flows from the end users upwards. The starting point is what gas is worth at the burner tip. Now, a lot of calculations went into valuing what the gas was worth at the burner tip in relation to oil and other fuels. Okay, and this was turned into turned into an art form in Germany and other continental countries. That was the starting point for pricing. By deducting the infrastructure tariffs at each stage, net prices can be calculated at each point along the journey. The city gate, the gas company boundaries, national borders, and even the wellhead. The alternative fuels selected were light fuel oil, commonly used for space heating, and heavy fuel oil, widely used in industry. Coal was already falling out of favour, even back in 1962. Some end customers managed to negotiate a minority percentage of coal into their oil index formulae, but this was the exception rather than the rule. Notably, the system had no place for the price of fuel into power generation. Before 1988 in Europe, natural gas was considered too valuable a fuel to be squandered in power generation. And so how did the commercial structure actually perform? Well, I don't think slides actually get much clearer than this. You can see that natural gas quickly displaced energy, quickly displaced other fuels. This is just the domestic sector in the Netherlands, but in other countries and other sectors, you saw a similar pattern, maybe different rates of penetration of gas into the markets. But oil indexation was remarkably successful at what it wanted to do. Okay. So as a result of this success, under the new pricing model, the gas industry boomed. New long-term contracts were negotiated, and fragmented gas industries across Europe became linked by national and international transmission systems. LNG volume arrived as early as the 1960s, firstly from Algeria and then from across the world. One exception in the story was the UK, which, although one of the largest markets, was not yet connected to continental Europe. Although oil index contracts were used, they differed in structure from those in continental Europe. This was the golden age of the European gas industry. Netback pricing ensured expansion, stability, and profitability. Franchise gas companies harvested the markets, making huge profits. The last thing that they or their shareholders wanted was change. However, oil indexation had one serious flaw that was beginning to be exposed. Gas was becoming abundant, but prices based on oil did not reflect this. Everyone was happy, it seems, except the customers. Who spoiled the party? A key driver for change was the large customers. They thought, in many cases correctly, that they were paying too much. The initial point of attack was not so much on the wholesale price of gas, but on the excessive margins between the border and the end customer. End users across Europe lobbied hard, even in Germany and Italy, but major changes first occurred in the UK. And why? Margaret Thatcher had been elected in 1983, and privatisation fitted well with her missions to shrink the state sector and encourage private enterprise. And the government needed money too. British Gas was actually sold intact in 1986, but the government appointed a regulator with a mission to open the markets to competition and eventually break up the incumbent gas company, which it did in 1996. Moving on to the commoditisation of gas in Europe, the unexpected consequence of liberalisation was the accelerated exploitation of discovered gas fields. New players emerged rapidly and began by undercutting British Gas and then each other. By 1994, the market was oversupplied and prices fell dramatically. Increasing levels of over-the-counter trading quickly developed into published daily spot prices. This is where Patrick Heron, who you might have heard of, entered the picture. Then, in 1996, modifications to transportation pricing created the NBP hub. 34 years after the Nota de Puce, natural gas pricing reached its next stage of development, and gas in Europe became a commodity. By 1995, when British Gas was allowed to compete on price, it had a major financial problem. Market prices were much lower than their oil index prices. British Gas was forced to unbundle at this point, leaving the marketing arm to renegotiate contracts. In return for more favourable prices, Centrica paid billions of dollars in compensation to the gas producers. Some of the contracts renegotiated in the period from 1996 to 1999 remained at oil index prices, but most were revised to market prices. Commodity markets could have remained confined to the UK, but the gas industry lobbied government hard for a pipeline connection to Europe. In 1998, the UK became connected to Europe by the interconnector pipeline with a massive 20 BCM of capacity, which was much more than was actually required. In 1998, the European incumbents were still harvesting the markets and making large profits. They feared the interconnector, but defences were well prepared. Gas flows were constrained to specific routes. And the UK volumes, what gas that was available in the UK at the time, was actually sold to continental incumbents under oil index contracts of up to 15 years. And these were negotiated before the interconnector actually began to flow. At the time, nobody really expected this to be a game changer in continental Europe. Planning scenarios indicated that the gas surplus in the UK would last perhaps until 2004, 2005. And after that, the interconnector flow was supposed to turn round. The interconnector was supposed to be an import pipeline to the UK. But when spot gas volumes became available too, into continental Europe, at low prices, the incumbents got greedy, started buying the spot gas at low prices. They were able to absorb the volumes into their purchase portfolios and resell the gas to customers at oil index prices, much higher prices, making a lot of money. All they had to do was nominate lower takes on their long-term contracts. They could make hay while the sun shines and then return to business as usual around 2005. There was really nothing to worry about. In parallel, they were using every trick in the book to limit the impact of EU legislation, effectively blocking competition from the essential infrastructure, such as pipelines, storage facilities, and distribution networks. Before moving on to the legislation, I'd like to discuss the concept of the middle ground. Rule number one for the oil-indexed incumbents was defend the middle ground at all costs. Avoid oversupply. So what is the middle ground? Under the oil-indexed contracts, the volume commitment of the purchaser is typically to buy 85% of the annual contract quantity. The seller's obligation is to supply a maximum of 110 to 115% if requested. Now, these are typical numbers, not exact numbers for any particular contract. If the purchaser nominates less than the minimum bill quantity, he still has to pay for 85% of the volume, and this is called the take or pay clause. Any gas that is paid for but not taken can be recovered in a later year. But if you don't take the gas within a limited period, you lose it altogether. And if you lose it, that's about $300 million for every BCM of gas that you don't take. So it's a lot of money. It's a big loss if you don't manage to take it. If the oil index wholesalers in aggregate can stay within the middle ground between the 85 and 115%, they have the flexibility to absorb the impact of any market price gas that becomes available. Commodity market prices can be controlled by the oil index purchasers using the daily nominations flexibility. If the market is undersupplied, then commodity prices will rise above oil index prices, resulting in problems for the market priced purchasers, but less of a problem for the oil indexed players. However, when there is too much gas, and this is what we're heading to, when there is too much gas, commodity prices fall, Oil index suppliers lose market share, and their problems can spiral out of control. Their only option is to go back to the suppliers and renegotiate prices or volumes, or volumes. The next four slides illustrate the preconditions for the crisis that hit European markets in 2009. First thing was legislation. But in continental Europe, despite the lobbying from industry, governments were generally not keen to see their flagship gas companies broken up. The EU clearly had a fight on its hands. And that fight was really about the ownership and control of the system. Competitors needed to get access to the gas system. Well, EU legislation is a bit like a bike shed full of tools. You know there's a tool in there to do the job, but you can't always remember where it is or how to use it. Fortunately, back in Brussels, somebody had taken the trouble to reread Article 86 of the treaty establishing the European Community, which clearly stated that energy utilities were subject to the same competition rules as private companies. In 1988, the EU published its intention to create a single energy market in Europe, and that meant competition. Gas transit was a major issue. The EU won a small victory with the Gas Transit Directive in 1991, but became aware that each battle, painstakingly won, simply took you to the next layer of resistance, and there were many layers of resistance available to the incumbents. So, back to the tool shed for a bigger tool. The one they picked out was the EU Gas Directive. Learning lessons from the UK, the EU laid out a timetable for the introduction of competition into gas markets. Unfortunately, negotiations weakened the power of the directive. This was a directive that you had to get the agreement of all the EU countries. In fact, everyone, even those that opposed with it, had to agree it. And so you had to have negotiations which considerably weakened the power and took the sting out of the third-party access clauses. So there was, at that point, to be no level playing field. However, the first directive was a very large foot in the door. By the time it became effective, the EU was already targeting improved infrastructure access with a second directive agreed in 2003. At last, the advantages of the incumbents could be eroded away, allowing new players access to gas supplies and customers. So all it needed was a bigger tool and 15 years of practice. The 2009 crisis ran parallel to the negotiation of much improved third energy package, which becomes effective March 2011. Amongst the many articles of this package, it requires the unbundling of pipelines, storage facilities and marketing operations. It also establishes a European regulatory body, which incidentally is already there. Okay, the contagion of European markets. As the interconnector began to flow to Belgium, a spot market price began to develop at Zeebrugge. At first, it was only trading across the flange between the players. Gas couldn't actually get into Belgium. The interconnector had been set up very cleverly so that no gas could actually enter Belgium. It could flow through Belgium to Germany, it could flow through Belgium to the Netherlands, but it couldn't actually enter Belgium for the first couple of years. As forecast, UK gas flows to Europe began to fall towards 2005. And then they did the unexpected. Flows actually began to increase. At first, Norwegian gas flows to the UK increased. And then new LNG terminals with a capacity of 30 BCM per year were commissioned. The incumbents had underestimated the potential of short-term supplies from Qatar, Norway, plus the broader LNG markets. And what effectively happened was that the UK became a bridgehead for supplies into continental Europe via the UK. This was effectively a surprise attack on the continental incumbents. Throughout this period, second-tier players in Europe, that's one layer below the large incumbent wholesalers, and it also includes new players like electricity companies and oil companies that chose to enter the gas market. So you had a large number of these second-tier players, as we call them. They were mounting attacks on the oil index markets and learning fast. They were expanding outside of their historic market areas. In fact, players that were incumbents in some countries became second-tier players in other countries in preparation for the previously unthinkable gas-on-gas competition. From 2000 onwards, European gas demand forecasts were not materialising. They were inconsistent and frequently revised downwards. Power generation gas demand in particular was sluggish. Oil index pricing had considerable risks for independent generators. Also, there was a lack of gas infrastructure liquidity and power structure liquidity, and a mismatch, quite a serious mismatch, between gas and power market nominations procedures. In short, the potential for gas-fired power generation in Europe, which was already factored into demand forecast, remains unfulfilled. Adding to the demand errors, European incumbents had overpurchased as a defensive strategy. To keep competing gas out of market, and to convince regulatory authorities that competing supplies were not required. In other words, if you thought that the regulatory authorities were looking at you and considering competition, you went out and bought more gas to convince the authorities that competition was not required. This was the game that they were playing as a defensive tactic. British Gas had tried that and come unstuck. Now the incumbents were trying that. By 2008-09, the European supply position was commensurate with a market size of over 600 BCM a year. In other words, the gas purchases in aggregate could support a market size of 600 BCM. Yet, even in the overheated economy of 2008, European gas demand was just over 560 BCM. And most of the oil index contracts were running close to their lower limits. Downward flexibility under the oil index contracts amounted to only around 50 BCM a year. So the incumbents would find it impossible to retain the middle ground if the markets turned against them. By 2009, we had what could be described as the perfect storm. Everything seemed to be pointing towards 2008 as a period when several trends would converge and create oversupply. Little did I suspect, or many other people, at the beginning of 2008, that two even more powerful forces would coincide with the existing trends to create the perfect storm. Shale gas production in North America was increasing at unprecedented rates and displacing LNG imports. And this could only be absorbed in Europe or Asia. And Asia wasn't looking for more gas. Additionally, in mid-2008, gas commodity market prices plummeted as demand cratered to less than 530 BCM. The agile second-tier players used the low prices as an opportunity to capture new customers in continental Europe. As the sales of oil index gas fell, the sales of commodity-priced gas actually increased. Result, Gazprom suffered export sales reduction of 14% and a revenue fall of 39% in 2009. And Sonatrach of Algeria suffered the same problem. Customers breached their contracts, missing their minimum bill commitments, in some cases by a wide margin, and they would need to pay under the take-or-pay clauses. Would they do so? Throughout 2009, the incumbent wholesalers became aware of the looming minimum bill problems. At $300 million per BCM shortfall, wholesalers owed billions of dollars to Gazprom and Sonatrach. Under the Russian sales contracts to E.ON of Germany, press reports quoted a figure of $700 million owing to Gazprom. Overall, minimum bill payments payable by incumbent wholesalers, mostly Russia and Algeria, would have amounted somewhere in the order of $3 billion, payable due in October 2009. And we know that some of these bills were paid and other buyers were let off the hook. One of the problems here was that end customers had similar clauses in their contracts, and they didn't have the cash liquidity to pay the wholesalers, and so the money couldn't flow up the chain to the producers. So a lot of the times they were let off the hook, but with bills owing for the future. The prospect of 1 year's worth of payments may not have been too daunting, but the threat of prolonged recession and more market-priced supplies was even more daunting. Some of these contracts still had 30 years to run. Clearly, the financial stakes for the producers are high, and for the wholesalers, they were potentially crippling. And from this, you can understand why the incumbent wholesalers were reluctant to allow competition into their traditional market areas. One thing is certain. The gas producers quickly got the message that the wholesalers' contractual problems were becoming the producers' problems. The middle ground had been lost, and the market was now in oversupply. If nothing was done, oil indexation could disintegrate. Indeed, at this point, many commentators felt that oil indexation in Europe had already reached the end of the line. But the oil index fought back. What happened to relieve the pressure? Firstly, the suppliers, notably Norway and then Russia, made concessions on price, but more importantly, on minimum bill volumes. Gazprom was at pains to point out that these changes were temporary and, come the end of oversupply, that they would resume business as usual, as there wouldn't be enough market price gas to go around. Since then, two significant drivers have also moved in favour of oil price indexation. Firstly, demand is on a rising trend. And secondly, long cold winters enabled the incumbents to meet their downwardly revised minimum bills and even have some headroom, which the incumbents then used to purchase market-priced supplies. Market price supplies could even have been higher. Production startups have been delayed. Terminal outages have been high, and pipeline supplies have been curtailed for a variety of reasons. Some commentators have suggested collusion between suppliers, or oligopoly behaviour, or commercial restraint of production. I don't really have an opinion on which of these is true, but could even be a combination of all three. Oil indexation made adjustments to survive 2009-10. The lesson here is not to underestimate the resilience of the oil index contracts. Continental contracts had price renegotiation clauses, which relieved the pressure on some buyers. This was something that British Gas did not have in its contract in 1996, but wished that it had. So, how long will oil indexation survive? These long-term oil index contracts were designed for an era when monopoly suppliers could pass costs through to their customers. Today, the contracts are fundamentally incompatible with end-user needs, or indeed, the EU's vision of a competitive single gas market. In some countries, the battle for commodity markets has clearly been won. Elsewhere, the industry remains divided. Then, in August 2010, the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, spoke out in clear support of commodity markets, and this was seen across Europe as a direction marker for for the highly influential German gas industry. The Russians are the most vocal advocates of oil indexation. This is understandable in view of the fact that it has been the price model underpinning almost the entire development of Gazprom export and much of the Gazprom revenue base since the 1970s. Algeria is strongly aligned with Russia, but less vocal. These two countries together supply more than one third of Europe's entire gas needs. The stakes are simply too large for the producers to walk away from oil index contracts. The defenders of oil indexation cling to the belief that the oversupply will disappear by 2015, and then they can resume business as usual. This is very similar to the continental incumbents' belief in 2005, that interconnector supplies would disappear by 2005, and that didn't happen. We cannot turn the clock back. European legislation continues to improve third-party access, liquidity, and competition. And these are fundamentally incompatible with the oil index culture. This leaves the following possibilities. Firstly, dramatic revolution, possibly a resurgence of the oversupply of 2009, causing urgent and revolutionary renegotiations. That's just one possibility. Second possibility, a negotiated revolution, where oil index purchasers jointly negotiate a switch from commodity market, switch to commodity market pricing with the key producers. And that would probably involve the payments of quite large sums of money. Third possibility is an evolutionary transition to market pricing. New oil index contracts are no longer being signed. To the European wholesalers today, you have a triple risk. You have price, volume, and regulatory risks. And that set of risks is simply too large. When they signed these contracts, there was only really one risk, and that was volume risk. Now you've got three risks. So oil indexation, because people won't sign new contracts, oil indexation could naturally just die a slow death. Another possibility, and this one's quite real, one that they're worried about, is the next tranche of EU legislation. This depends on their ability, on the EU's ability, to identify the next big tool and their willingness to use it. However, the most likely agent for the next big change is a combination of the above. It was just such a combination that created the near revolution in 2009. The next time it happens, liberalisation and commodity markets will be further down the road, and the movement away from oil indexation may be easier. Let me leave you with one final thought. If you were to ask the question in Europe, which is the most important market price in Europe today, the answer would almost certainly be the NBP commodity market price, rather than the German border price, which is the measure of the oil index price. As in the UK in 1996, oil index prices are still there, but they are becoming obsolete. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony, very, very much. Thank you for the very informative presentation. I'd like to open the panel for questions. Please identify yourself as well.
Roman Zajtek, Middle East and Central Asia Department, International Monetary Fund. I look at your road ahead. There's one bullet point that is missing to me here. We assume that oil prices will be so high as they are today, 20, 24 times, 25 times higher than 1 million BTU in the United States forever, and therefore the index cannot work. I think that's an implicit assumption.
Yes.
There should be another assumption that oil will need to restore its competitiveness in the market.
Yes.
And the only way it can happen is when the price of oil falls.
Yes.
Is it possible? What do you think about this scenario?
The oil price falls. I'm not really an oil price forecaster.
I think the biggest fear of the oil index buyers, and the oil index buyers are becoming increasingly uncomfortable with their oil index contracts, and their big worry is that oil prices go through the roof. So gas could be plentiful and oil scarce, and they're paying a price that's linked to the oil index. Yeah, that's a big threat and a big worry to them. Does that answer your question? I think, will they fall? I don't think so, but then I'm not an oil forecaster.
That's a very interesting condition. However, I think the determinant is the fact that oil is predominantly a transportation fuel, and there is not gassed oil competition in transportation. So as long as transportation demand is there, I don't see the direct possibility of that fall until we find a substitute for oil for transportation. I just don't see that linkage being as tight as it could be. But it's certainly possible. We've had, within the last 20 years, oil at 15 a barrel where nobody thought it would be so.
There is another interesting point I'd like you to comment. Mikhail Korchemkin, East European Gas Analysis. In the past 10 years, oil reserves has added, it's like we got another Saudi Arabia. And in terms of gas, in the same period, we got another Russia. But the cost of this incremental addition is very different. It's like, what's the most expensive oil is maybe produced $50 a barrel. And but gas is, we're talking about an equivalent of $10 a barrel. So this is another good reason to break the link.
Yes, I would very much agree with that, yes. Yes, I think when you look at the world gas reserves, 60 odd years of gas reserves, 40 odd years of oil reserves. You look at the Hubbard curve. We're further along the curve for oil than we are for gas. You know, the two markets really are fundamentally different. And why should you link gas to oil prices? You know, in the early days, you didn't have anything else you could link them to in the 1960s. You know, it worked. It was a good system. Now it's sort of come to the end of its useful life. And really, in my view, it should be replaced now by something else, by commodity markets.
I just have a factual question, I guess, kind of related to what's just been said.
Could you identify yourself for the others?
I'm Mary Barcello with IHS, Cambridge Energy Research Associates. In the United States, many years ago, there was a de facto linkage between oil and gas prices because there was so much substitutability of gas with oil in primarily the electric power sector, and there it just worked out. If there was a lot of boilers could physically switch from gas to oil.
Yeah.
That is no longer the case. There's because of the lower gas prices, most everything has already switched. But I think that's the genesis for the oil-gas price linkage, at least in the United States. And my question just is that physical switching capability still present in the infrastructure in Europe?
Between oil and gas, very little, to be quite honest. I think that there always is. If you look at, very long-term energy prices, there's always a link between gas, oil, and coal. You know, they tend to go up together looked at on a very long-term scale, and that always has been the case. I think the linkages on a shorter term, the linkages come and go. You know, they're there one month, they're not there the next month. You know, because conditions have changed slightly. You know, particularly in power generation, for example. You know, as coal plants switch on and off. So linkages come and go. Yes, there is the long-term linkage, but I think a lot more short-term dislinkage, if you like.
Okay. Tane and... Oh,
go ahead. Let's take two questions or two or three questions, and then you could probably answer them so that as we are having like five more minutes. So.
Sure. Robert Johnson from Eurasia Group. You mentioned Sonatrach and Gazprom as sort of the incumbent exporters and their preference for maintaining oil indexation.
Yeah.
What do you think the view of Qatar Petroleum is on the oil indexation question as a lower cost producer? How comfortable are they with prospect of a shift towards more commodity based pricing?
Okay.
Let's get another question as well.
Yeah, that's a good one.
There was a hand there, Thane Gustafson.
Thane Gustafson, Cambridge Energy and Georgetown. The standard Russian answer, Alexander Medvedev's answer, is we're perfectly happy to sell our LNG into North America at commodity prices because spot markets in North America are deep and liquid. Medvedev goes on to say the same is not true in Europe as yet, and consequently, spot markets in Europe are subject to manipulation. That's a risk for us as long-term planners. My question to you is, at what point would you say that spot markets become sufficiently deep and liquid in Europe to satisfy a reasonable investor in supply? Have the Norwegians, for example, given any indication as they move gas into the UK that they can live with the depth and liquidity of the UK spot markets? At what point would Gazprom say, okay, we're satisfied?
Yeah, yeah. I like that question.
There was another question over there. Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael Ratner with Congressional Research Service. If we just assume that oil indexation goes away, can you comment about how you see supply, demand, and prices reacting in the kind of medium term?
Okay.
So I guess we have quite enough questions for...
indexation goes away. Right. Okay, yeah. The first one was the Qatar. Yes, yeah. Qatar. Yeah, I think there are a number of countries that are, let's say, less consistent with their messages than Russia and Algeria. You know, Algeria and Russia have been very firm with their messages. Norway used to be very firm with its messages, and then they started selling. They knew that they needed to sell gas into the UK to expand their export sales. And they became much more aligned to the EU single competitive markets. Qatar doesn't have to comply to EU legislation, so they can do what they like on pricing and reach arm's length deals. And they're selling a lot of their gas on oil index and some of it increasing amounts into spot markets. And so in fact, everyone thinks, well, spot market prices are lower. I don't think they necessarily take the view that spot market prices are always going to be lower. And it's a good thing to have, a mixed portfolio, some oil index sales and some spot market sales. I think that's probably what Qatar think. Although within a lot of these companies, not just Qatar Gas, but even, E.ON of Germany and Eni of Italy and Gazprom itself, you do have a mixture of views and different camps. Within Gazprom, notably, there's the Gazprom Marketing and Trading in London who sell gas at spot market prices, buy and sell at spot market prices. And so within a lot of companies, there's a mixture of views. However, the Gazprom and Sonatrach are the two firmest, I would say, on that one. On the liquidity question, I think it's a very good question because it's a kind of chicken and egg situation. If Gazprom did start selling a lot of market price gas into European gas markets, then the liquidity would be very good. The fact that they don't makes the liquidity bad. liquidity, it comes and goes. There are companies out there that probably can control the liquidity quite easily, including Gazprom. Particularly Statoil is in the perfect position to be able to do it, and some people suspect them of doing it. But having said that, there's a good churn rate at the NBP hub, less so at the European hubs. And certainly most people feel that the NBP hub, gives a good liquid, market price. But, it's never going to be perfect, and even oil markets are, subject to manipulation at times. Well, so it's said. What the churn rate is, well, nowhere in Europe yet achieves churn rates as good as, the NYMEX markets. I don't think you need them that high. But certainly most people feel that the UK NBP is a liquid hub. And most other hubs in Europe tend to follow the NBP rather than, as much as setting their own prices. Okay. Does that answer the question? Can I?
What is the trend and what has been the response of the Norwegians as they base their sales more and more on spot sales?
I think the trend has generally been upwards for liquidity in Europe, and particularly in the last few years, as more spot market priced supplies have become available. Liquidity has improved, not in Italy or Spain, but certainly in Northwest Europe. The Norwegians are treading a fine line, if you like, between the demands of the Russians and the demands of the EU and the demands of their customers. It's always a very fine line. I saw Gazprom praising them for some statement that they've made about their marketing of gas. So it is a fine line that they walk. They have to comply with EU competitive market legislation. So they have to be careful what they do. I mean, they've had their offices raided by the EU before, and it'll probably happen again. And if the EU suspects them of doing the least thing that's untoward. So, it's easy to take a look at their position and say they can manipulate the market. It's not quite that easy.
Okay. There was a question on the, if you assume the end of oil indexation.
Yes, if oil indexation goes away, How can I answer that? It's a good question. Perhaps... I said there are two cultures in Europe, two different mindsets. You have the mindset of the commodity markets, and that's a very different mindset from the mindset of oil indexation. The mindset of oil indexation is one where volumes and prices, flows of gas are all very, very tightly controlled. You don't want anything to disrupt that control that you have over the market. It's a controlled situation. Commodity markets thrive on commodity market brokers think that they bring, order and harmony and balance to chaotic markets. And, oil indexed players think that commodity markets bring chaos to ordered and balanced markets, if you like. I think if you flipped your mindset from the oil indexed balanced flows, and if the German, the German gas industry tomorrow said, okay, what we need is just loads and loads of supplies. We need South Stream, Nabucco, we need a pipeline from Iran and everywhere. What we need is just loads of gas and prices will go down. That's a different mindset. And if they ever adopt that mindset and, get oversupply, then, that'll be good for the European consumers. As it is, you've got, half of the industry that's trying to constrain the flow of gas to Europe and half that's trying to bring more gas in. And it's the whoever wins that balance will control the prices, if you like. Okay, does that answer the question?
Well, thank you very much, Tony. I would suggest that we have a short break, and I'm assuming that you may find the answers for some of your questions during the second panel, as we'll have 5 presentations, and we'll also have an additional Q&A session at the end of the presentations.
Well, thank you very much again. To welcome you back, we are starting the second panel right now, and please take your seat so that we're starting a very interesting discussion. We have, as I mentioned, we have five discussants, which each of them is going to cover a very interesting theme related to the gas markets, and also in response to the report that we have launched today. I will start with power generation, and each time I will be introducing the speaker separately so that we don't go too long. Let me introduce the Honorable Branko Terzic, who is going to be talking about power generation and its link to gas. He is the Executive Director of Deloitte Center for Energy Solutions and Regulatory Policy Leader, and also Policy Leader in Energy and Resources for Deloitte Services. He is the current chairman of the United Nations Economic Commission for Europe ad hoc group of experts on cleaner electricity production. He is the current member of National Coal Council. Formerly, Dr. Terzic was a commissioner at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and also Wisconsin Public Services Commission. Dr. Terzic is a member of the Planning Committee, Bordeaux Energy Colloquium, Executive Council Energy Efficiency Forum, and New America Foundation Energy Advisory Council. His columns appear in Energy Metro Desk and European Energy Review. He's also a private counselor to Crown Prince Alexander of Serbia.
He's been on the web. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And this is a formidable audience, because I know quite a number of you very well, and you're all more expert on the subject I'm talking about than I am. So I am chastised by that. Let me move ahead. Where's the little channel changer? There we go. Just to remind you that, at least for my career, I've been involved with two issues in the 20th century, one issue in the 21st. The 20th century issues have been securing adequate energy supply at reasonable cost, and making that available to consumers at reasonable cost. This is the Public Service Commission model. This is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission model. This is how we brought electricity to the one-third of the world's population. Only a third of the world's population has adequate electricity right now. A third has intermittent service, and 1.7 billion to 2 billion people have no electricity today whatsoever. We're talking here about natural gas for electricity use. The 21st century, we find us still with that issue of having to supply adequate energy at reasonable cost, but with the condition that we have a climate change issue. Not a certainty, a high probability. You can choose your own position on the political spectrum, whether you're a total climate change skeptic or whether you believe, as the International Committee does, that there's an 85% chance that our greenhouse gases are producing climate change. Somewhere on that spectrum, I'm reminding you that those of you who are in the military, if something has a 50% chance of occurring, we plan on it. I was only a captain, and a general told me that recently, so I'm going to believe him. We are talking about natural gas for electricity. I want to point out that we can also talk about natural gas for central station electricity, and as the former CEO of a gas company, I was always interested in having natural gas at the distribution for combined heat and power, something that we do not have good technology for yet in this country. Switzerland, other countries do have home units, natural gas, single cylinder engines, fuel cells, something that will convert natural gas to electricity with the heat reclamation, the small CHP or larger CHP at the head. We don't talk much about that use of natural gas, but it is one that's out there, that's potential. I think we're lacking some good, transportable, easily installable technology, but in many parts of the world where there is a distribution gas network, available for that, we have it there as well. And of course, the third option is the natural gas transportation, whether at a compressor site, at a central station, or at a home compressor. I just had a very interesting conversation with a gentleman from International Monetary Fund, and in many parts of the world, natural gas for transportation may be another use out there that will change significantly on a country-by-country basis the future of natural gas. This is the U.S. Energy balance. I use this in a lot of my presentations to remind audiences of where energy goes. As we mentioned, I mentioned earlier, petroleum is predominantly a transportation fuel. Natural gas has not displaced petroleum there. Natural gas is a combination of industrial, residential space heating, and electric production. In this country, electric production or natural gas will increase for a variety of reasons, including uncertainty over the climate change bill and over the certainty of the EPA's ongoing regulations, particularly the ones already in law with respect to fly ash and with respect to other chemicals, not CO2. We already have, and I have friends in the engineering profession, their companies are being called and asked to review existing coal boilers, big old fat existing coal boilers for conversion to natural gas, inefficient conversion to natural gas in those boilers in order to meet fly ash and other requirements. So there's already some of that going on, as well as the question of meeting need for new supply. Now, in the U.S. 2 years ago, every one of the NERC regions was at or below its minimum reserve requirement at 15%. The recession has saved us from blackouts. We had 35% reserve capacity in this country in the 1980s, for example, in 85, when I was a state commissioner in Wisconsin. So the reserve capacity issue, the issue of if demand picks up, if we come out of the recession, who's going to be ordering what? Natural gas turbines quickly installed will meet it. These are just some slides I'd included on projections for increased global natural gas demand. We'll just skip those and go right to Tony's paper. Excellent paper, and you can read these along with me here. The power generation is not amenable, mostly for independent competitive generators running on gas combined cycle. Long-term contracts may at time put you in a position where you're selling into an electricity market at low price and being required to buy high price gas with take or pay penalties. So that contracting. However, if you are in a baseload situation and your gas units are baseload, as we have here in the United States, you might much more feasibly get along with a long-term contract. The demonstration is that, so was a question about Norway, the spot markets in northeastern Europe are supporting combined cycle gas turbine development already, and the superior characteristics for this kind of from these spot markets is works much better with the competitive electricity markets and gas turbines bidding into competitive electricity markets. I agree with Tony that long-term oil index will not disappear from gas markets, not in the foreseeable future. But I like very much the Statoil Powio GSA, which Tony writes about. It may represent the way forward. It will allow gas producers to remain open to GSAs with the turbine developers, with the market developers. This will be a question of how quickly Europe wants to move to gas, clean air requirements, how well the carbon market works, a lot of considerations going into this with respect to the European marketplace. One of the things we didn't talk about was the issue of pipelines. Tony mentioned that the electricity, the gas directive and electricity directives in Europe both require third-party access, open third-party access. Europe, however, does not have the equivalent of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It has a weak committee-type organization. I think Tony was talking about the organization at Lord John Maugg. Lord Maugg runs the sort of committee of committees of state of regulators. They don't have the authority of the FERC, which dealt with the unbundling problem on natural gas in Order 636, where in this country, natural gas pipelines were taken out of the gas sales business and put totally into the gas supply business under straight fixed variable rate design, very important to give them the financial security, and the commodity was stripped away and they were forced into non-discriminatory policies. The difficulty that Europe has, of course, is their largest individual supplier of natural gas through pipelines in Russia is still in a bundled mode. And I think on the long run, it will have to be negotiations with the Russian government, with Gazprom, to demonstrate to them that in the long run, possibly an American model of a separate unbundled transportation with straight fixed variable rate design to protect the pipeline investment and then opening up the commodity to the separate issue of how you price the commodity. Now, I am talking as a former member of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which single-handedly screwed up natural gas pricing in what was the greatest screw-up in energy pricing probably in the 20th century, based on the Wisconsin versus Phillips decision in 1951, where the Supreme Court told the Federal Power Commission that they had misread the 1930s Natural Gas Act and should have been regulating natural gas commodity at the wellhead all along. In response, the Federal Power Commission came up with a convoluted, a complex and unworkable method, a series of methods of pricing natural gas, creating the unprecedented situation by the late 1970s in interstate commerce of high natural gas prices and commodity shortages as a permanent thing, while in the intrastate market, we had low prices and excess supply. Of course, Congress came in and wisely stripped the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the successor of the Federal Power Commission, from setting the price of natural gas. Immediately, a few months later, the average price of natural gas in the country dropped from $3.50 to $2.50 between October of 85 and February of 86, for example. In October of 85, I approved the purchase of $10 natural gas, $10 in MCF natural gas by the Wisconsin Gas Company. That was all that was available at the market at that time. So we have some good lessons to be learned about attempting to manipulate or work with gas prices. We understand how markets work. We also understand here, I think, that with respect to electricity, the flexibility of spot prices and hybrid prices, maybe spot for certain kinds of generators, long-term index prices, possibly for the baseload generators, may give the market. There is a need for new firm capacity going forward. That'll be very much dependent also on climate change legislation and issues. The new capacity has to come from dispatchable sources. You cannot provide firm capacity in the future from solar, wind, or other. It's not firm. New capacity has to come from dispatchable sources. Energy can come later under that umbrella from renewables. Natural gas has the advantages for electricity production in Europe and elsewhere of being available, deliverable, lower have CO2 emissions, and price competitively. And the natural gas contract forms will have to meet the dynamic means of competition and generation, or they just won't come. Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you, Branko, for a very informative presentation. Our next speaker is Velo Kuskra. I'd like to invite him here. He is the president of Advanced Resources. He has over 40 years of experience with unconventional gas. He's a member of the Potential Gas Committee and is the author of over 100 technical papers on energy resources. Recently, he authored a three-part series entitled Gas Shale Transformation, published in the Oil and Gas Journal. He and his firm assist domestic and international companies to identify opportunities for gas shale, coal bed methane, and tight gas sand plays in the U.S. and worldwide. He currently serves on the board of directors of Southwestern Energy Company and on the board of directors for Research Partnership to Secure Energy for America. Mr. Kuskra is a 2001 recipient of Ellis Island Medal of Honor that recognizes individuals for exceptional professional and patriotic contributions by America's diverse cultural ancestry.
Could you put on my slides?
Certainly.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for that very warm introduction. I'm pleased to be here. And if you look at the title of my talk, Unconventional Gas, Is It an Exportable North American Revolution? I hope to kind of put some background on that and then see whether this might be the source that creates the liquidity that, Tony, you talked about earlier in your talk. Well, for the U.S., really, it was gas shales that changed the outlook from what I call from fears of impending shortages, which we expected in the early part of the decade, to now expectations of plenty. And so just a few facts on that. Instead of declining, natural gas production has increased during this past decade. Unconventional gas provided 20 BCF a day and more than replaced declines in onshore and offshore production. And gas shales provided the big bulk of that. Now I can see. It now provides over 60% of U.S. natural gas production. And it's nowhere, when I first started talking about this, you know, they were wondering if I was really a reputable, and time has caught up. Just put some picture on it. Back 10 years ago, you had basically conventional and offshore gas, the big boys. They were in decline, and that led to a number of analysts saying, you know, we're into basically diminishing returns, or we need to really build large LNG facilities. What they forgot to look at was unconventional gas, which basically came to the rescue. Let's see. Make sure I got where I want to be. Whoops, I think I skipped one. Yeah, just a quick picture, the tremendous growth in unconventional gas, particularly gas shales, in the past 3 or 4 years, and starting with, you know, some of our big shale deposits. And at the very top, if you see kind of like in the dark purple reddish, is the Haynesville, which will end up being the potentially that and the Marcellus, the largest of them all. So I want to use this as a way to address the same kind of questions that I think will be need to be addressed in Europe, that we've begun to grapple with here in the U.S. We don't have all the answers yet, and clearly less for Europe, but this, I think, provides the fundamentals. Question first is, you know, how large is the resource base? Is it large enough to enable it to become a major climate change solution, support from the U.S. exports of LNG? We've had some steps towards that. How much can be converted to productive capacity at affordable prices? What's the role of technology? This is a technology play. This is what brought it about. How will that continue? And can you do it in an environmentally sound way? Well, I want to put, we hear a lot about the climate benefits of natural gas, and I want to say it's a 70% solution. For really old, inefficient plants, it can be even higher than that. Half of it comes from the lower carbon content. The rest of it comes from the higher efficiency of natural gas plants compared to coal plants. And so I just put that, combined those two, if you look at it, pounds of carbon per kilowatt hour. So let me kind of walk through for the U.S. the answers to some of these questions. I'll turn to Europe in a minute. It's large. Gas shales are about half of our unconventional gas resource. Tight gas, coal bed methane make up the rest, and we still have a large undeveloped conventional gas resource base. It's widely located. Most of the activity has been along the east and central part of the U.S. We have shales in the west as well, which are not quite as economic to develop. What really brought about the change, and you know, we've been developing gas shale. In fact, the gas shales were the first source of natural gas in Fredonia, developed over 100 years ago. But it was viewed as a small, high-cost type of resource, and what really changed the game is that it is now the low-cost part of the price-supply curve for U.S. gas. And that's really at the heart of the revolution itself. Policies, research, and technology had a major effect. I don't want to lose this because, you know, this happened in the past. No one remembers what happened 20 or 30 years ago, but it was basically a success story, and this could be a model for Europe. The DOE helped build the essential resource and science knowledge base. Without that, we would still be kind of punching holes in the blind. The Gas Research Institute basically did the early demos. When we started it, everybody thought that we were out of our minds. And then there were tax credits, and they weren't so important for pushing you over the limit. It was really, it attracted capital, and capital brought about other talents to the arena, and basically it brought us to where we are. However, I do want to point out that of this large resource base, still only a relatively modest portion is low cost. The rest of it still is looking for continued advances in technology. What changed the game is basically horizontal wells with multi-stage fracturing. I did some of the earliest work on horizontal wells for the Department of Energy in 1980 for the shales of the Appalachian Basin. And through the Gas Research Institute, began to develop the kind of feedback mechanisms that allowed you to apply basically hydraulic fracturing in a science way rather than blindly in the dark. Now, and a very critical question, both in the U.S. and particularly Europe, is can these be developed in an environmentally sound way? There's going to be a harsher spotlight on this development, and if the industry is going to be successful, it has to adopt what I believe is called green natural gas development. A number of things go there. I'll just touch on three of them. Reducing surface impacts, particularly as you begin to look at Europe and its higher densities population. Capturing methane emissions so that you truly have a positive balance. And then assuring that the wells are safe and the hydraulic fractures are safe in terms of drinking water and other effects. Well, the first one is actually relatively easy to solve. Reducing land use impacts, you can do that with multi-pad wells and multi-well pads. In fact, at Southwestern Energy, where I'm on the board, we find it's cheaper to do multiple wells from a single pad than do them the old way. There's nothing like good economics to drive good environmental practices. Reducing methane emissions, there is a EPA has an excellent program. Southwestern Energy joined it. It was one of the, got an award from being the best new entrant a few years back. The second thing is, if you look at the bottom of that, Williams Company, who's been one of the companies involved for some time, they've captured, as is now data that's a couple years old, 24 BCF. It cost them $17 million to do that. They sold it for $159 million. It's a good return. Again, economics drive you to good, in this case, economics drive you to good environmental practices. A third is, and the one that, of course, everybody is worried about. There's EPA has a study underway, legislation being talked about, basically doing your well and frack correctly. And that basically that's what it comes down to. If you do it incorrectly, you can cause problems and have caused problems. You need, if you do it correctly, you basically have steel casing and cement to protect groundwaters. You're working 5,000 to 10,000 feet below the water table. There's a lot of strata above you, 1 to 2 miles of strata that will protect you. I talked about the ability to look at the fracture. Microseismic can tell you where it's going, and those kind of dots that you see. This is a deep Haynesville well. You can see that the highest point of basically disturbance, which would be a small fracture, is probably about 300-400 feet above the horizontal well itself. And finally, strong supporter of disclosure. It's a personal view, not necessarily our company's view, and development of less environmental impact chemicals. We're actually developing certain sonics type of approaches to get rid of some of the bactericides. Now, to Europe, okay? We took our first look at Europe, and there are basically, at that time, three prospective areas, the Alum Shale of Sweden, the very important Silurian Shales of Poland, and the Mikulov Shales of Austria. We put a number of about 1,000 TCF in place, recoverable of 140. Just recently, we're doing a world study of gas shales for the Energy Information Agency, and we finished Poland. We're currently putting a recoverable, technically recoverable resource, not yet economic, of over 300 TCF just in Poland. It's a large resource. But it's a big but. The European gas shale geology is much more complex. Lots of faults. They certain areas, they could be conduits for water. And the way we like to do it is you really got to look at the well site, and every well becomes a PhD thesis. Might be a little overstated, but not by a lot. We do believe that the largest potential will be in Poland. The geology is somewhat simpler. The resource quality appears to be higher, and there are some exploration wells underway. The things we look for, is it silica rich? Is it mature, high in total organic content? No longer, you know, the trap, the source, et cetera, conventional gas, and those appear to be favorable in Poland. However, lots of constraints still, and the constraints are particularly impressive. We need to know, first of all, what's the size and quality of the economic recoverable resource. If you got $5 gas, it's one game. If you got $10 gas, it's a very different game. That's fundamentally has not been established. We're working on that, but we don't have an answer yet. You have to basically resolve the environmental consequences of hydraulic fracturing, water use, and disposal. They can be done. We have the technology to do it. We just need to make sure it's done right. Expanding infrastructure, there are some efforts underway to do that. Right now, there are severe constraints in this. The capital cost is going to be higher, at least 2 times those in North America, could be 2.5 times. What we've seen, however, is over time, costs come down. Wells get better. Just at our own company, in a period of about 3.5 years, we brought our costs down by almost threefold. Part of that better wells, part of that lower costs. And then better certification approvals and a transparent regulatory process. So let me conclude. The work we've done so far says we're relatively confident the U.S. has plentiful supplies. We now think, particularly in Poland, there are large supplies. The challenge is converting these resources into economically competitive reserves. Important to do this in a green development way, but if you do so, we think there are considerable benefits. In addition to working on the markets, basically, we think it can provide a substitute for old, inefficient power plants. It can increase energy security, either for transportation or low-emission power for electric cars, and importantly, improve the economy from lower energy costs, more domestic jobs, and an improved trade balance, both in the U.S. as well as in Europe. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for a very insightful presentation. Our next presenter is Mikhail Korchemkin. He is the founder and managing director of East European Gas Analysis, a consulting company that specializes in cost-benefit and financial analysis of natural gas projects in the former Soviet Union. His previous experience includes performing numerous feasibility studies for the USSR Gas Ministry, now Gazprom. He has consulted numerous corporate and governmental clients in the US, Europe, and Asia. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak at this meeting. I'd like to give a brief history of the gas competition in Europe and focus on Russia, and specifically on the most recent gas plan to 2030. Yeah, before I start, I'd like to show this interesting chart I picked up at Reuters just a week ago. There's nothing like global LNG market. The prices go different ways and differ by region a lot. Actually, do we have a pointer? Most people see in the right portion of the chart part of a wave, but Gazprom normally sees it as a trend. Just a reminder that 2 years ago, CEO of Gazprom made a forecast according to which today's price of gas in Europe should be $30 per MBTU. Actually, Gazprom is selling now at $8. Anyway, this also shows that, no surprise, it became reasonable to re-export LNG from Freeport, Texas to Japan. And maybe we'll see exports of LNG produced in the U.S., not just re-exports. Now back to Europe. The history of competition in this decade was a permanent and steady loss of Gazprom. Somehow in the 90s, Gazprom was gradually increasing its market share. This chart shows just a share of major suppliers in imports from outside of the European Union. And these are the numbers for OECD Europe, which is mostly the whole Europe plus Turkey, with the exception of, I think it's Bulgaria and Romania, and minus the Baltic states. So it's a very representative picture, and the numbers of BP Statistical Review show the same trend. So Gazprom was steadily losing. It indicates that they were doing something wrong, especially in the first, early part of the decade, when there was no objection to against buying more Russian gas. Simply, it was apparently a matter of price. And in the final period of this decade, the gas war with Ukraine, when Gazprom shut supplies to Europe for 2 or 3 weeks, plus the crisis and the appearance of the unconventional gas in the market helped added more to this decline. Numerically, Russian exports increased, but this growth was well below the market. You can see that Norway has added more, increased sales much more than Gazprom. Gazprom's incremental sales were just marginal compared to the development of the whole European market. Actually, this is 10 years of Gazprom being under the control of Vladimir Putin. And looking at this, at the performance of Gazprom, I must tell that gas, international gas business abilities of Mr. Putin are exaggerated by the media. Yeah, if you compare Russia with Norway, this chart shows monthly sales of Russian gas and Norwegian gas to OECD Europe. Norway was more successful. The gap between Norwegian supplies and those from Russia was narrowing, and if in June 2005, Norway, Norwegian exports to this region represented just 42% of the Russian volumes. And in the end of the period, the last month is June 2010, Norwegian sales represented already 87%. It's hard to, looking at the financial reports of these two, of Statoil and Gazprom, it's hard to tell why exactly and what are the prices of sales to Europe, because Norway, Statoil sells a lot of gas to the UK. But I think that Norwegian price must be substantially lower to give incentives for importers to buy more gas from Statoil than from Gazprom. Yeah, Tony Melling already used this quotation of Mr. Putin. I took it from the English version of Putin's website, official website. There was also a discussion or exchange of opinions between CEO of Ruhrgas, Klaus Schäfer, and Vladimir Putin, who is effectively CEO of Gazprom. Mr. Schäfer, in the end of August, said that it's time to change the long-term contracts. They do not reflect the realities of the today's market. Mr. Putin responded in Sochi, ordering Gazprom to stay tough and do not not to give in. And today's Russian business daily, Kommersant, has an interview with Mr. Schäfer, where CEO of Ruhrgas, Ion Ruhrgas, says that, repeats that the Russian contracts has to be changed. Specifically, the price level, which is the base price, indexation and renegotiation rules has to be adjusted to market realities. And he also added a very important line that Ruhrgas needs to keep Russian gas imports at the current level, which means a very low level. There is not going, the German company is not going to import more gas unless Gazprom changes the contract rules. Another interesting point that Russians' pipeline investment program is not does not depend on market situation. Gazprom wants to build 25,000 kilometers of new pipelines irrespectively, whatever the market situation is. The new version of the Russian natural gas strategy to 2030, which is a gas plan, has some controversial lines. For instance, in the risk section, they do accept a risk of low gas demand in Europe. And surprisingly, they add a line that to minimize the risk of low demand, Gazprom is building, expanding pipeline, export pipeline capacity, which is kind of inadequate reaction, I think. In my view, there is a serious risk of bankruptcy of Gazprom because of huge costs to be, huge capital to be invested into the expansion of pipeline system, which is not needed. So Russian gas will be less competitive in the market because of sharply decreasing load of the whole gas transportation system and increase of transportation cost. And looking at the Russian part of the market, the growth of domestic price of gas is limited. Just in 3 years from now, Russian industries and power plants will be buying gas at prices higher than now in the U.S. Yesterday, Vladimir Putin had a meeting with top Russian gas and energy officials, and they approved this 2030 gas plan. The surprising part of this meeting was a very realistic talk of the energy minister of Russia. It indicates that there is an opposition or some hints of opposition inside the Russian government. Specifically, the energy minister mentioned the scenario of flat gas demand in Europe, which is discussed by the European Union. Just a few weeks ago, Putin said that all experts indicate that European market will grow, will need additional 200 billion cubic meters just in 10 years from now. The energy minister also pointed out that the additional European demand can be met by imports of LNG from sources out of Russia. And then he worried about the pipeline expansion, export pipeline expansion plan, mentioning that the capacity will reach 350 billion cubic meters compared to the current or last year export of 141 BCM. And he also questioned the competitiveness of Russian gas in Europe if this pipeline construction plan is realized. Nevertheless, Vladimir Putin set the 2030 production target at 1 trillion cubic meters per year, which is 50%, nearly 50, about 50% increase from the level of 2010. For some reason, Mr. Putin and whoever the authors of the gas strategy believe that the current market situation is better than in 2005, when, for instance, the Russian industries were buying gas at $12, $20, and $30 per MBTU, thousand cubic meters, which is less than $1 per MBTU. They expect the consumption to grow faster at the prices of $150, $200 per thousand cubic meters. In my view, the unrealistic demand and production numbers are needed for one reason, to justify the construction of the 25,000 kilometers of new pipelines. It's all about kickbacks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mikhail. Our next speaker is Hidehiro Nakagami. He will provide the importer's perspective in this gas, in the changing global gas markets. Hidehiro Nakagami is a vice president at Tokyo Gas, and he's representing Tokyo Gas in their New York office. He's managing the research about Atlantic LNG markets and supply demand in the U.S., and in the past, he has been also in charge of spot trading and LNG inventory management of Tokyo Gas.
Thank you. Thank you for your kind introduction. Again, I am Hide Nakagami from Tokyo Gas. I'm based in New York office right now, but talking about my career in the past, I'm more on the commercial side rather than analyst or research staff. So if I could share with you today about the what had happened up to now and what would happen in the future in the market of Asia or the Japanese market, talking about the LNG. So here's my agenda. So this slide really shows the LNG demand and supply in Asia. By the way, I really appreciated what Tony has said. I know we as a Japanese or in Asia, we are in a market where really 100% constrained almost. So we are in a mindset of the constrained world, whereas you in the US or Europe, even Europe is more liquid compared to the Japanese market or Asian market. So I'm from that kind of world to express this slide today. Okay, so again, this slide really shows LNG demand and supply in Asia. This bar chart really made by Institute of Energy Economics Japan, what we call IEEJ. They expect the LNG demand in Asia would be somewhere in between 200 and 300 million tons per annum. And with this slide, I would like to specifically emphasize is that the orange part, which they called portfolio LNG, which was originally destined for Atlantic market, but thanks to the weak demand in Europe or Atlantic, we could enjoy this portfolio LNG, which had been and would be diverted to Asian market. And this volume would affect the prices in Asia, of course, in Japan too. And this portfolio LNG would be really supplying Asian demand up until sometime when this portfolio energy would find strong demand somewhere else other than Asia. The next slide shows energy demand in traditional Asian market. Traditional, I mean Japan, Korea, and Taiwan here. As you can see, up to 2030, we will have a strong increase in LNG demand. But as for the long term, demand outlook for power generation in Japan is expected to shrink significantly. According to the government's strong will to decrease CO2 emissions, which is expressed by the Strategic Energy Plan of Japan in June this year. Whereas, on the other hand, natural gas shift from oil, especially in the industry sector, in city gas business in Japan, would grow significantly, roughly more than 20 million tons per annum. So talking about Japan specifically, we will still see the transition from oil to natural gas, rather than more shift onto the power generation sector. Talks about the Korean and Taiwanese demand. They are also recovering more strongly from the recession. One of the important factors we have to carefully look at includes the demand-supply gap that is resulted from the gas industry restructuring happening in Korea. As for Taiwan, we have to carefully look at the fourth nuclear power plant in Taiwan when we look at the demand from Taiwan. So even bigger uncertainties are China and India, where policy priority either over pipeline or energy import is not still clear. For your reference, IEEJ forecasts that China's LNG demand in 2020 would be 24 million tons per annum, whereas Wood Mackenzie expects that to be 46 million tons per annum. So with that, you can see, you know, high range of the outlook based on each institute or consulting firm. One of the important factors for the China's energy demand in the future is that whether Central Asia and Russia will continue to supply the majority of their gas to Europe, or they will become swing producers between Europe and Asia. Now, talks about the supply side. Looking at the conventional gas supply potential for Asia, there are ample supplies, especially in Australia and Russia. As previously mentioned, LNG cargoes are being and will be diverted from Atlantic market too. This cargo flow, once again, would affect landed LNG prices to some extent, or to large extent in the future. Additionally, there are plans of new types of LNG projects that utilize new technologies such as floating energy in Southeast Asia. In addition to conventional gas resources, there is a number of unconventional gas projects, not only the pipeline gas, but also LNG. I'm talking about CBM-based LNG projects that is around Australia, east side of Australia. And one of them is almost close to commercialization. And we are one of the buyers from such kind of unconventional LNG resources, we as Tokyo Gas. And China is believed to possess significant shale gas potential, and exploration and production are being already implemented in areas like Chongqing and Sichuan. While resource base of unconventional gas is huge, there is uncertainty about shale gas development in relation to mainly environmental as well as political consequences. So talks about the global energy flows. Traditional LNG flows are from Southeast Asia, Australia, Middle East, to Northeast Asia, as you can see the big arrow right-hand side. And another big flow is from Africa to Europe, as you are already aware. Fewer trades have been made between Asia and Atlantic market. However, Middle East, especially Qatar, has emerged as the swing producer, and new liquefaction and regasification terminals have been constructed in many countries. And these and the price difference between markets, mainly Atlantic and Pacific, with that situation, we expect liquidity of LNG market to be enriched. But here, I mean, liquidity is not so liquid as American or not so liquid as European. Again, we are in a really constrained world, we as a Japanese or Asian market. So thanks to portfolio energy, which I mentioned earlier, we have been seeing the inter-regional trades and expect that situation to be continued until these supplies find solid demand somewhere once again. Traditionally, pricing vary between the regions. Crude oil linkage in Asia, oil products linkage in continental Europe, and hub-based pricing mainly in the US and UK. But hub-based pricing is becoming more influential recently in continental Europe because many people have already mentioned they are succeeding to reflect the current demand-supply balance to their prices, not only the spot, but also the contract prices. hub prices decreased significantly below oil link prices. Again, this created the huge price differential in between Atlantic and Pacific. Due to the fact where portfolio energy being and to be diverted from Atlantic to Pacific, spot-based pricing is not only be influential in Europe, but also would be influential in some way in Asia. Again, with that said, we can tell that the interactions between Atlantic and Asian markets are being increased, not only physical flows, but energy pricing as well. Talks about a little bit about the European energy transactions. Vertical axis shows the million tons per annum import to Europe, whereas the horizontal axis shows the timeline. As you can see, although the natural gas demand in Europe has been decreased due to the recession mainly, they have increased the import of LNG. Mostly, they have increased spot and short-term contracts, which is, of course, linked to spot price, meaning hub price-based low-price LNG. And, sorry. So here's my summary. So there are several points that I'd like to emphasize. Firstly, that everyone should know or should be already aware is that there would be ample supplies in the future from conventional as well as unconventional, almost all over the world. Secondly, pricing changes in continental Europe has been resulting in downward pressure on natural gas prices on term contract. Not only the spot, but also the term contracts. That is the key issue. And, spot-based pricing to timely bring some influence on Asia market, that will bring cross-regional trading from Atlantic to Asia market as a catalyst, which is good for importers like us in Japan. And this will also bring good opportunities for Atlantic-based LNG players or LNG sellers because they can find any new business opportunities in Asia, which is historically and will be probably a higher, they have a higher price compared to the ones in Atlantic, so that they can enjoy this economical benefit as well. And this LNG flow from Atlantic to Pacific will stimulate healthy price competition in Asia market, which again has been really constrained market only by traditional LNG suppliers. And if prices being adjusted in Asia, more natural gas demand in downstream, then more LNG sales by suppliers, which will bring benefit to suppliers as well. That had been my presentation. Lastly, although we as Tokyo Gas is really local distribution company in Japan, we are a vertically integrated local distribution company, which I mean we do own upstream equity in somewhere around Australia, and we do also have a fleet, LNG fleet, and we do own LNG receiving facilities and distribution networks. So although we say ourselves as a local distribution company, we are very much global company as well. So we do own offices around the globe, New York, where I am based in. Of course, the headquarters is Tokyo. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Hidehiro. I would like to start start the discussion now, and we'll have a Q&A session. And I guess we have about 20 minutes for that. And after that, Chris Goncalves will provide a wrap-up, which will summarize and raise quite a few additional questions as well. I'd like to start to kick off the discussion by asking a question directed at Velo first. You provided a great overview of the constraints that are facing European unconventional gas development. I just wonder whether, if you imagine a scenario where Europe is shifting towards hub-based pricing predominantly, would that be a constraint or would that foster the development of unconventional gas in Europe?
I think if you would add to that, what do you think the hub-based price would be? And then I can help answer that question. I think it really does come down to the quality of resource and its economics. We've seen in the U.S. unconventional gas change from the highest cost resource to now the lowest cost resource. It took some time. That was a 30-year process. It shouldn't take as long in Europe because we can learn from the past, but there are other constraints that will stand in the way. I don't expect much to happen in the next 5 to 10 years, but after that, I think basically it's uncertain at that point. If the gas quality is really high, there will be large amounts of domestic, starting with Poland and then possibly in Germany, potentially in Austria, some in the Eastern European countries as well, Ukraine, Belarus, and so on.
Thank you, Ella. Yes, please.
As far as you have, Mike. When do you expect the first results of Polish cost results for Polish shale gas?
Okay. Well, part of it, is being developed now. It really becomes an issue of public disclosure of the results. I mentioned some of the exploration wells that are going on. And I've got a good idea of what the costs are. The costs are quite high. Probably looking at well costs of 10 to 20 million. However, what the big issue, uncertainty, is what's the productivity. And we just, at this point, don't know. That has not been made public. It'll be up to how much will be required by the companies to divulge. If I can see basically some fundamentals and early IP, can tie that to geology, we can get that answer relatively quick. Hold that back. It could be some time.
You're talking about years.
If they're allowed to hold the test results confidential for 2 years, for example, then that's right. At the point where the test results are available, those who know the geologic setting where this was done can tie that and begin to extrapolate across these various basins.
Thank you. Let me open up the session for question and answers. Please identify yourself and also the person whom you would like to answer the question, as we have quite a few presenters. If you like, you can still ask questions for the author of the study. He's here.
So many questions today. Robert Johnson, Eurasia Group again. Mr. Kuratemkin, I really enjoyed your presentation. I share your skeptical outlook on Gazprom, and I think the number of people who are willing to believe in a Gazprom bankruptcy now versus 3 years ago has increased. But I'd be interested in your opinion on the other side. What could turn it around for them, right? How do they avoid the debacle that you're outlining? Is it a matter of just cutting back on some of those pipeline projects or being more flexible pricing? Can they make that switch to a more flexible pricing market? Be curious to know your thoughts.
Most important thing is the excessive pipeline construction program. It's something that can change the performance, the company's performance for that. We need to stop the construction of do not to launch the South Stream project and stop the construction of the link between Yamal and the existing system. The old plan of Gazprom assumed the Yamal reserves to be linked with the currently producing reserves of West Siberia. It's a short link of less than 500 kilometers. And the depletion of currently producing reserves goes on at exactly the rate the new production from the mall would come. So it's a perfect combination of depletion and new production and utilization of the existing capacity. Currently, Gazprom plans to abandon a good working corridor of pipeline from West Siberia to Central Russian Europe and build a new system, which is wrong. Overall, the load factor of the whole system will be much lower and possibly much higher. Second, as to the export sales, it's we need to estimate the benefits from reduction of price. Because it's better to have smaller profit than not to have any profit at all. And they are doing exactly that. They are selling at the minimum, and they don't have any new sales in the near future. Nobody wants to buy Russian gas on this day. And they are unable to sell new gas, sign new contracts at the lower price, competing with the existing contract. So they need to address the existing contracts, but as Neil Rogers suggests.
The question, how much can Russia raise the domestic price of gas? Is there room to raise the domestic price of gas to cover some of Gazprom's shortfall?
Right, this is a very good question. It's Russian industries are a very low efficiency, fuel efficiency. So, and I know some sectors I've seen for industries like trigger production estimations of the top price they can supply. And if the price goes above that, they will be down, not the business. So, the easiest things to predict are the Russian steel sector, steel production, fertilizers, and some other chemical production. They will be out of business. It's like, if you wish, it's like if the government decides to keep Gazprom alive and kill the rest of the economy, or do vice versa, like in the old days, Gazprom was subsidizing the whole Russian Federation nearly and kept the whole industry alive. So the choice is it cannot be done in 3 years' time as the current plan seems. It's the Russian companies do not have free capital to invest into improvements in energy efficiency. It should be, and most importantly, Gazprom wants to enjoy both the most important point, both the monopolistic position and extremely high pricing. The real market price of gas in Russia is much lower than what Gazprom believes. Until 2 years ago, December 2008, Russia had a gas exchange. And where small volumes, about 5 to 10 million cubic meters a year, were sold by independents and Gazprom at free market price. And the free market price has never been even a half of the European price minus duties, minus transmission cost. So this is the real market price of gas in Russia. And that's why Gazprom has closed the gas exchange. So you cannot be a monopoly and enjoy market price from elsewhere.
Thank you, Mihail. Any other questions?
Yeah, John Lyman, Atlantic Council. What if the current plan of Putin's is to keep the pressure on Europe and the Nabucco pipeline, et cetera? But what is the possibility that his real game plan is to not build all the pipelines in any case, but to simply start preserving the cost and the budget in order to start moving pipelines more in towards China and India?
Yes, the market does not promote the construction of any pipeline to Europe right now. First of all, the current export capacity of Gazprom is about 200 million cubic meters a year, while the actual exports are 140. And they have never been at full capacity, ever.
So from the standpoint of European consumers, it's good to have excessive capacity because it would put a pressure, but not the producers, I think, understand the risks, except for Gazprom. They simply consider it as the... Actually, it's an old plan of, I think, of Vladimir Putin, who wanted to encircle Europe by Gazprom. And the idea was to buy all gas produced around Europe and resell it on Gazprom's terms. But fortunately for European consumers, there is too much gas around and nobody can buy all of it. Simply, for instance, the Turkmen reserves, when everything, this doctrine was developed, Turkmen reserves were underestimated and Russia wanted to buy all of them, all Turkmen gas. Now they see it is impossible. Same with all other reserves brought in by new technologies and geological efforts. If you look from the standpoint of Turkmen or Azerbaijan producers, Nabucco is the shortest link between them and Europe. Route through Russia and South Stream is 1,000 kilometers longer, and costs are higher. So the netback from sales through Nabucco would be higher than in case of selling through Russia. And yeah, there is another point why Russia does not need all the South Stream pipeline. It is designed to re-export Caspian, Turkmen, and Azeri gas. But this business does not generate any profit for Gazprom. Gazprom buys it at the price equal to European price minus transmission cost. There may be a dollar of profit, not more. So, but the basket, the export basket of Gazprom remains the same. So if you add more foreign gas, which is exported at zero profit and tax-free, then you have to reduce the Russian gas, which is the major generator of export duties for the state budget and profit of Gazprom. So it's a no-win situation.
What about the movement, possible movement to China?
It's expansion of the current Sakhalin LNG plant is the best way. But Gazprom is trying to combine it with extremely long pipelines, which is a way of making contractors and intermediaries of Gazprom wealthy. So if you add additional transportation costs through long and very expensive pipeline, that would kill the whole project. But LNG in Sakhalin is a very good option.
Well, you have a question.
Yes. I'd like you to stand up. About a year ago, Gazprom dismissed European, both Western and Eastern European, unconventional gas as a myth. And I'm curious to know
what their viewpoint is today. Is it still that, or is it emerging?
At the most recent shareholders meeting of Gazprom in the summer, Miller, the CEO of Gazprom, repeated that shale gas is a PR campaign similar to global warming. And all of it is just paid publications by Western companies, presumably. But 2 weeks ago, Gazprom placed a tender to organize a shale gas conference. I think you are invited.
Yeah.
Are you? You have to be. Are you invited to that seminar?
Yeah, I can't go. I have a.
So it looks like they have changed their mind and started to look at shale gas seriously. But they would still keep naming it a myth.
Okay, I see a lot of the attention is on Russia, which is naturally the largest exporter. Are there questions that are not related to Russia especially? Okay.
David Gottfried, Department of Energy. I'm wondering, this is a question for Mr. Melling. I'm wondering about, I guess, two-part question, today and March 2011. What is the capacity for individual power generators and large wholesale consumers, cement facilities, et cetera, to access these spot market prices directly in Europe? And I guess the second part of that question is, if they are able to access these markets directly, what is the future for E.ON, E.N.I., et cetera, these large wholesale, quasi-statal energy buyers? Thank you.
Yeah. So was that specific to any particular country?
I'm interested in E.ON in particular.
In E.ON, yes. Okay. I think in Germany it still depends where you are as to what prices you get, because the gas, as the gas flows down the gas chain to the smaller distributors, it gets considerably more expensive, and so people like cement producers, for example, would not get a gas price by the time it reached them that would match the fuels that they're currently using. Cement manufacturers are notorious for using the cheapest possible fuels that they can get away with, from a carbon perspective. Yes, I mean, in theory, there's a full connection between the border and the end consumer, and anyone can access that. But as I say, it does get more expensive. So consumers can also access. Power generation consumers can also access gas, and theoretically at any point in Germany. The problem with power generation, there are a number of problems, but one of the biggest ones is mismatch between the power nominations and the gas nominations, which is improving, but unless you have a nomination procedure where you can actually nominate the right amount of gas for a prompt period in power generation, then you have this mismatch. And in that case, it restricts the short-term opportunities. And that's what's happening across Europe. The short-term opportunities are very difficult to access. And in fact, that's one of the things that the EU has on its agenda for the next stage of legislation, is to provide a much better match between and a much better interface between gas and electricity, particularly the CCGT power generation markets. Nominations for pipeline capacities just don't match the nominations for the electricity markets in a lot of areas of Europe. There's, for example, the balancing mechanism in gas can be, in some cases it's daily, some cases it's hourly. in electricity, can be half hourly, I think even quarter hourly nominations, and so you don't have an exact match. Yeah,
I'd like Tony and Hida here to comment on one thing. Hida said that historically, Asian, specifically Japanese market, has been the one with the highest price of LNG. But this has changed lately. We have seen prices of in Japan, LNG price in Japan, below the price of pipeline gas in Europe. So what do you think will be? Is it a sign of globalization or just a trend of unexpected thing to become true?
Yes.
Same as anticipations of continental companies in Europe back 10, 15 years ago.
That's true. I don't think I was the one that said that LNG prices in Japan were higher than elsewhere, although they are. I mean, it's quite clearly some lower price cargoes getting through to that market, and it's becoming a slightly more liquid market, which is a good thing. I think it's the spot market is always going to be quite responsive to price, particularly in LNG. Yeah.
I guess I'll take one final question before the wrap up.
Sorry,
you had a comment. Great.
So I am sorry that I'm not really aware that there has been lower prices in Europe than Japan in the past or recently, vice versa or whatever. So, but the one thing that I should have mentioned in my presentation is that the question is the European prices now affecting in Asia or in Japan? The answer would be yes, but it's really, really limited yet. And having understood the negotiations between traditional energy buyers and traditional energy suppliers in the Asian market, to my knowledge, there had not been yet really the changes of indexations from oil to, let's say, Henry Hub or NBP. So, and considering that most of the energy imports to Asia, or specifically Japan, is comprised by long-term traditional contracts. So although I repeatedly said that the European price is really affecting, but the magnitude is really limited. So to answer your question, it might be affecting something, but not really entirely changed paradigm or so yet.
Okay, we had one chance for last question.
One question is, the second largest natural gas resources are in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and it hasn't been mentioned here. How do you, I don't know, one of you, or maybe someone else, how do you see the role of these resources in the next 25, 30 years? They haven't been tapped much, but they are there.
Does I answer that? I mean, I think, there's what Europe is looking for is reliable supplies. We've already seen we've seen some supplies coming through from Iran, through Turkey, and there have been a lot of quality problems with those, and so Turkey has actually cut down a lot on the volumes. It's very difficult to tell whether that's actually that they just don't want the gas, they've got too much gas, or whether it is real quality problems, but I'm sure there's certainly an element of quality problems there. I mean, I think as soon as they get the quality problems right, they get the supplies right, and they come up with a convincing package then I think that will be attractive to Europe. And I think, I think there are people in Europe that will buy it, you know, and it probably come through Turkey. So it's out there as a resource for the future, but I think as people see it right now, you know, it's just not at a state of development where people would people consider buying it. And so assuming that the, you know, let's say trade restrictions go away, then, you know, I could see it flowing one day. But then again, somebody else might come along and displace it.
Great. We are moving on to the wrap-up session. Chris Goncalves is going to provide this very broad overview of the gas markets. Let me say just very quickly a few words about him. He is a vice president in CRA's energy and environmental practice. He has over 20 years of experience in the energy and financial industries. He has a broad expertise in strategic business planning, economic and market analysis, regulation, commercial negotiations, project development and financing, asset transactions, international carbon markets, and the UN Clean Development Mechanism, and is an expert in testimony for energy litigation and arbitration disputes. He has advised clients on energy infrastructure and commerce involving LNG, natural gas, oil, power generation, and renewable energy. His experience spans the Americas, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Eurasia, and the Middle East.
Thanks, Adnan. First of all, let me congratulate Tony on an excellent paper. I think you've truly captured the drama of the moment in terms of what's going on in Europe. The metaphor of the battleground is appropriate. It's fascinating to see somebody with your wealth of knowledge putting together really a tour de force about the issue and understanding very clearly where the battle lines are drawn. So I think that's been an excellent discussion. Also, I wanted to congratulate Adnan on putting this together, because this is, from my perspective, I go to a lot of conferences, I participate in a lot of discussions, and this is one of the best sort of global gas discussions with a wide variety of perspectives, really from around the world, truly expert in Asia, in Europe, in Russia, and so forth, the United States, that we've really got a great view of perspective. So this is a very tough act to follow, and I'm going to do my best to wrap it up. I don't think there'll be too much time for questions afterwards, although if you would like to have a few, I'd be more than interested in the discussion, or I'll stick around for the coffee. I'll figure out if I can make it work, first of all. Where's the page down? This one?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to give some data, and then I'll try to address the pressing question at the end. I'll be brief here because we've already addressed the issue of the growth in shale, really tremendous growth of over 10 BCFD over the last 6 years. Difference between my numbers and Bello's is just the inclusion of the Canadians. Approximately 7 BCFD just in the last several years. Really tremendous growth by any measure. Actually, let me just put that in perspective. The last 4 years at 7 BCFD, that's about 70 BCM. That's about 70% of the UK market, just to give it a context. I looked into the liquefaction project news over the last several years to see if my hypothesis that LNG has been pulling back as a function of this vast supply of shale was correct. A lot of people are arguing that has happened or is going to happen, and it's not actually correct. There have been some cancellations and suspensions in the Middle East, namely the two Iranian projects. There was a small cancellation in the Atlantic, but there are also very substantial additions in the Pacific, a lot of new Australian projects coming to market, so that you get a net increase of 4.4 BCFD of capacity, or about 44 BCM of new LNG proposed for the market just over the last few years. And we've already identified that the Russians aren't backing off either. So when you look at the impact on prices, we have here a chart of WTI oil index, Henry Hub, the US major hub price, NBP in the UK, and GBP, the German, I'll call it the quasi oil index price, although arguably lately with some gas market impacts creeping in. And you can see a very distinct change in the trend from pre-2006 to after 2006. A little bit of disruption around the onslaught of the crisis in late 2008, but then pretty quickly back to the same pattern, where you have U.S. and European gas prices ranging from half to two-thirds of oil prices on a BTU basis. So what's going to happen in the future? We've discussed and identified that liquidity is probably the most critical issue to understand in thinking about whether prices will continue to become more competitive, liberalize, whether the spot market prices, the LNG liquidity will continue to pressure long-term contract prices, oil index prices in Europe and around the world. So let's go through supply and demand and see where we may get. These are independent results coming from our global gas and LNG models. In a moderate scenario, and I want to emphasize moderate scenario for climate and environmental compliance, there's nothing substantial here in terms of a big carbon policy on a global scale or anything like that, but there is continued growth in North America, Europe, and Asia in gas that's related to gradual switching from coal to gas in the power sector and so forth. You see that total gas demand in the major LNG importing regions, we're including a few major producers like Russia and Australia, but the places that import LNG growing by about 62 BCFD by 2020. Very substantial growth of, I think, about 30 BCFD in Asia at about a 6% clip, but also meaningful growth in the Middle East itself, as well as about 9 BCFD, 90 BCM in Europe, and about 70 BCM or 7 BCFD in the United States. On the supply side, unconventional gas production and LNG production could each increase over 20 BCFD, which would trump a 10 BCFD increase in pipeline imports from FSU and Africa into Europe and Asia. This over the next decade, we are making those adjustments that were referred to by Mikhail, I think, in our FSU scenario. We're including Nabucco, Nord Stream, and Medgas, and excluding just about everything else. We're including about 5 BCFD of capacity into Asia from FSU, including the Caspian. And altogether, that roughly 15 BCFD of capacity running at an approximate 70 to 75% load factor gives the additional 10. But I think it's quite striking that the LNG production capacity and the shale capacity are really forcing the pipeline gas back into the future. North America, contrary to some perceptions, will need LNG for growth. Unless you assume a very conservative demand scenario or a very optimistic shale production scenario, and we have the range of scenarios that we're working with here on the screen in terms of the brown and orange colors, you just don't get the additional gas in the United States needed for the growth of the 7 BCFD. And that's simply because the decline in conventional production is so substantial. Essentially, the shale production growth is required to offset that decline. And in an optimistic scenario, it may exceed that decline by some measure. But to truly achieve additional growth, some level of LNG will be required. The green area reflects our view of LNG available to the United States after every other market in the world has been served. So that's, in a sense, you could say surplus LNG or surplus available LNG available to North America. And if you look at the demand numbers on the chart there, you see the United States requires approximately half of that. So there's still some surplus out there. Looking at prices, comparing shale gas production costs from our shale gas model with an outlook for LNG opportunity cost prices driven by a forecast of European prices, you see that only in the short term is there really any intersection. Overall, the range of shale gas production costs from the highest kind of costs we're looking at, including a reasonable return, to the lowest costs is pretty consistently below the opportunity cost of an LNG cargo diversion from Europe. What that says to us is that the U.S. will import surplus LNG only. We'll do it on a seasonal basis. and it will probably be able to get essentially a discounted price for the LNG compared to a European price. In other words, it will be LNG that Europe does not require. So where does it all go? As far as this notion of how deep the spot market prices penetrate into Europe, or whether and to what extent those that kind of pricing pressure starts to make itself felt in Asia, you have to understand, first of all, that there is a reasonable chance of a surplus gas supply continuing over the next decade, not just for a couple of years, as Gazprom suggests, that North American prices for gas are likely to be below the world level for LNG. And then you can look at the shipping differentials in the various basins. These are very high-level figures. They're based on a lot of averages. You can't take every route and for every cargo and simplify it very easily. But we've done some weighted averages and some simple averages just to give a flavor of it. And if you look on the left side of the chart for North America versus Europe, costs from the Middle East, which is clearly the largest supplier, it costs about 30, 40 cents more than it costs to go to Europe. So you would think the price signal into Europe would be around that order of magnitude higher, but still based on gas. And looking at Asia, it costs, for several of the markets, not India, which is so close to the Middle East, on that same order of magnitude, more to go to North America versus going to Asia. And some of the Asian markets, like Japan and Korea, from a shipping cost perspective, could be, and these are average shipping costs over a decade, could be on the order of rough parity with European prices. Just to give a flavor for where those price signals might be. I wanted to use this slide to tee up discussion, but I didn't realize that the discussion would have been over by now. But I'll just throw out my two cents on that, and if we have some time for discussion, that would be great. I guess my own view is that the culture of oil index pricing in Asia, because, as Hide said, the culture of the gas market in an island economy or a peninsular economy like Japan and Korea, an economy that's not traditionally integrated with other gas markets, doesn't have a lot of cross-border pipelines, is such that the perception, at least, is of constraint, is of limited supply and dependence on LNG for supply. And so the question becomes, to what extent any level of surplus available in the market starts to break down that perception and create opportunities to renegotiate existing contracts, even on a term basis but with a different pricing index, or to take some risk on a certain level in a supply portfolio on spot market pricing. I think the signals are there. The numbers that you saw in our surplus figures are not enormous. There has been some pullback on supply, and if you take a conservative view of some of the Russian FSU supplies by pipeline, then you do get a tightening of the market over the next decade. But in an environment of surplus with a lot of competition coming from the Australians and the Qataris for new trains coming to market, you probably also know the Qataris have been sort of shut down partially for the last half year, trying to basically re-engineer some of the terminals and get out more supply from those terminals. All that volume's coming back to market next year. I think there could be, you know, a 2 to 5 year period where there's enough supply on the market that the buying power is substantial and you see increased risk taking. I don't believe that oil index pricing is gone or will go away anytime soon. I don't think there's that much market power. And I also think those old habits and the culture of buying gas in that way will die hard. So I think it's a shade of gray somewhere in the middle, and it's more likely to be a process subject to dispute and negotiation, maybe dispute in Europe, renegotiation in Asia, than it is to be anything as dramatic as a global revolution. So those are my comments. Any questions would be great.
Thank you, Chris. Unfortunately, we will not have time for questions as this place needs to be vacated pretty soon. I would like to thank each of our presenters for excellent presentations. And also, I would like to thank all of you for coming here and especially for staying with us throughout these two panels. It's been over 3 hours already. Thank you very much.